The subject of tonight's shiur is tips for waiters, halachic subtleties of waiting between meat and dairy. The Midrashim tell us that the Malachim, the angels, were opposed to Klal Yisrael's receiving of the Torah. They did not want us to receive the Torah. It was too holy. They felt that Klal Yisrael did not deserve to have the Torah. As the pasuk says in the 8th chapter of Tehillim, Ma enosh kisiz kirenu. There are various accounts in the Midrashim of how Moshe Rabbeinu and HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself responded to the claims of the Malachim, and there's a fascinating account in the Midrash on Tehillim, on that very chapter, on Kapitel Ches and Tehillim. The Midrash on the Pasuk, Mipi Ololim V'yomkim Yisadeta Oz, says that after the angels opposed Klal Yisrael's receiving the Torah, finally, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God himself responded to them. Halachatem kishiyaradatem etzel Avram achaltem botza b'cholov. When you went and visited Abraham, what we read 2 weeks ago in Parshas Vayera, you ate meat and dairy. Shenemar v'yikachem b'cholov uben ha'okar asher osa. It says in the Pasuk that they ate butter and milk and the meat that Avraham Avinu prepared for them. So you guys, you angels, ate basa b'cholov. V'tinok shalahem k'shabomi beis ha-sefer. And human children, Klal Yisrael's children, when they come from the school, v'imo nosenes lo pas basa b'cholov, his mother would give him meat dairy. V'omer hayonim b'ni rabbi lo sevashal gadi b'chalev. No, I just learned today in yeshiva, you're not allowed to do that. So what you guys did, even the young children of Klal Yisrael know better. Midrashim are often phrased in parables, deep ideas are expressed in apparently simple stories. There's obviously a deep concept in this Midrash, but it's not immediately clear to us what the Midrash means to convey. I'd like us to keep this Midrash in mind. At the end of the shiur tonight, I have to come back and try to explain what this Midrash means. So the subject of tonight's shiur from a halachic perspective is waiting between meat and dairy. We know that Torah says three times, Lo sevashel gadi b'chalev imo, shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk. And the rabbis of the Gemara had a tradition that this means to teach us really three things, since it says it three different times. One time is to teach us it's forbidden to cook meat and milk together. Even if I don't eat it, they may not be cooked together. I had a friend who attended a culinary school to learn how to become a chef, one of the top-of-the-line culinary schools. And one of the shots he encountered was that he could not prepare dishes that were basa b'chol. He could not put them into the oven, because even though he wasn't going to eat it, even to cook it, if it's real basa, which is beef, and real cholov, milk from a kosher animal, that is forbidden even to cook together even when you're not eating. That's the first prohibition. The second, of course, is the prohibition to eat it. And the third is to derive benefit from such a mixture. So achila, bishul, and hana are all forbidden min ha-Torah. By the way, it's only meat of a kosher-type animal and milk of a kosher-type animal. I once had an incident where somebody ate something that they thought had a hechsher, and they had taken the wrong product off the shelf. It turned out they ate something that wasn't kosher. And doing research, the only possible non-kosher ingredient, and it happened to have been derivative of pig meat. So the person wanted to know if he was fleishig. So the bad news was that he ate non-kosher. The good news is that he's not considered fleishig in halacha because it's not a kosher type of meat. And the same is true if the milk is not milk of a kosher animal. It does not make one. It's not considered basar b'cholov. Okay, the Rabbanon, however, expanded these prohibitions. Min ha-Torah, it's only forbidden to eat meat and dairy that are actually cooked together. But if you have a piece of cold cheese and a cold piece of meat and eat them together in a sandwich, min ha-Torah, that would not be forbidden. But of course, the Rabbanon said rabbinic law prohibits even such a mixture. And not only beef, but the Rabbanon extended it to poultry and milk is also aser. Among the other prohibitions that the rabbis added is that they forbid us to serve meat and dairy on the same table. Isser ha'ala, a table that you eat from, so you can't have meat and dairy products, because people will, just out of habit, eat one and the other. They'll end up eating meat and dairy together. And finally, another prohibition that the rabbis made is that there has to be some form of waiting, some form of separation in time between meat and dairy, which is what I want to discuss tonight. So the first primary category is waiting from meat to dairy, after having eaten fleishigs, waiting before eating milchigs. And then a secondary topic of discussion is the opposite. Is there a necessity to wait from dairy to meat? Okay, so the Gemara does refer to waiting after meat before eating dairy. The reasons for this are one of two. The primary reasons are offered by Rashi and the Rambam. Rashi says after I've eaten meat, it has a strong taste, which remains in the mouth for some time afterwards. So we don't want to eat dairy when we still have the taste of meat in our mouth. That's Rashi's explanation. The Rambam says, Maimonides says there's a concern that there are strands of meat caught in the teeth. Meat is a type of food that's liable, it's likely to get caught in the teeth, and therefore we have to wait the requisite amount of time, after which the meat will be considered to have been dissolved. Even if it's there, it's no longer physically or halakhically considered to be meat anymore. These are two reasons. Either the taste that remains in the mouth or the concern that there are particles caught in the teeth. There happens to be a significant halakhic ramification, significant maskamina between these two reasons. According to Rashi, that the problem is the taste that remains in the mouth. So this is only true if you swallow. The poskim say, according to Rashi, it's only if one swallows the meat. But if I take meat into my mouth and I chew it, but then I spit it out, I do not swallow it, according to Rashi, I should not have to wait. On the other hand, according to the Rambam, if a person swallowed meat but did not chew it, so there's no concern that the particles got caught in his teeth, they weren't exposed to his teeth, he only swallowed, so according to the Rambam, that case should not be a problem. According to Rashi, if I chewed but didn't swallow, it shouldn't be a problem. And according to the Rambam, if I swallowed but didn't chew, it should not be a problem. One would expect that therefore we would figure out which opinion we follow and therefore come up with the appropriate leniency. However, the verse can tell us that we follow both opinions. L'chumra, we take both into account and the stringencies of both. So therefore, if one chewed but didn't swallow or swallowed but didn't chew, either way, the person is considered quote-unquote fleishig and would have to wait the appropriate amount of time. However, if a person neither chewed nor swallowed, simply took the food into his mouth and then spit it out, he is not considered fleishig, according to the poskim, because that does not run into the problem, neither according to Rashi nor according to the Rambam. Now, how long must one wait? So there's a very interesting statement in the Gemara. Mar Ukva was one of the great scholars of the time of the Gemara, one of the great Chachamim, and the Sechas Chulon, Daf Kufei, says a very interesting statement. He says, I, in the following area, am like vinegar, the son of wine. I, in comparison to my father, am like vinegar versus wine. Compare an inexpensive, foul-tasting bottle of spoiled wine or vinegar versus a very fine bottle of wine. It's a much lower quality item. So he says, that's me compared to my father. Why? Because if my father ate meat today, he would not eat dairy till tomorrow at the same time. He would wait 24 hours. Whereas if I eat meat at this meal, I'll eat dairy at the next meal. And all the commentators explained that his father did was considered a stringency, but what Ma'ukva did is the halacha, that one must wait from one meal to the next. However, there are two ways we can understand this. Perhaps Ma'ukva simply means you can't eat meat and dairy in the same meal, but as long as you end one meal and start another one, the first one could be meat, and the second one could be dairy. In fact, the Balei HaTosfos, the authors of the Tosfos, right there on the page, say that that's what it means. It doesn't mean necessarily from lunch to supper. It just means from one meal to the next, even if one simply ended one meal and immediately started another. However, other Rishonim, other closer commentators, explained that that is not what he meant to say. He meant, in the normal terms, one, in the times of old, they would eat two meals a day. They'd eat one meal in the late morning and one meal in the early evening. So from brunch to supper, that's the amount of time that one must wait. These are two opinions found in the Rishonim. And fact, the Shulchan Aruch tells us that one should wait 6 hours, which is an amount of time given by many of Rishonim as being the assumption from the morning meal to the evening meal would be a duration of about 6 hours. He is following the more stringent opinion. The Ramah says, technically, we could follow the more lenient opinion, that it really does not require such a long amount of time. However, he says it is appropriate to be more strict and to wait the full 6 hours. According to the author of the Shulchan Aruch, the source of Sfarah custom, it is law that one should wait 6 hours. According to the Ramah, according to the source of Ashkenazi custom, the law might follow the more lenient opinion, but the minhag, the custom, is to be more lenient. This is significant. Certain lenient considerations that come from the fact that the Ramah says it's really just a custom and not absolute halacha that we wait 6 hours. Now, some of us are familiar with various other amounts of time. Some Rishonim say not 6 hours, but kemoshe shos, like 6 hours, or kishe shos, as 6 hours. This is the source, perhaps, for the tradition that some families have. Cutler is reported to have had such a tradition that it's not 6 hours, but maybe 5.5, or some hold even just into the 6th hour, which is 5+. The Pri Chodesh, one of the great poskim, interestingly says it's not an exact amount of time, but rather it depends. In the summer months, the morning meal was in the morning, and the evening meal was in the late evening, before it got dark, which would be late. In the winter months, supper would be eaten earlier because they wanted to eat before it got dark, so it depends. In the summer, it would be a longer amount of time. In the winter, a short amount of time. It's not a set amount of time. This is an interesting opinion, not generally followed today, but taken into consideration. Jews of German descent have a custom to wait 3 hours. Some Dutch Jews have a tradition to wait 1 hour. There are different amounts of time. Everyone should follow their custom. Again, the most common custom is a full 6 hours, as mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch. Interestingly, the Aruch HaShulchan says that the 6 hours are calculated from the end of the meal, from when you recite the Birkas HaMazon, the benching, not from when you finish eating the meat. However, common custom follows the more lenient practice, which is as soon as the meat is finished and we go on to other parts of the meal that perhaps are part of, like a dessert, we can begin the stopwatch from when we've finished eating the meat. That is common practice, to start the calculation from then and not from the later time. Now, after eating what must one wait? So certainly if one ate meat, we have to wait before eating dairy. However, the post can tell us that the custom is even what's called a meat tavshil. A tavshil is something that was cooked with meat, but it's not meat per se. A potato from the cholent. You don't see any meat in it, but it's flavored with meat. It's considered fleishig and halacha. Anything of that sort requires us to wait the requisite amount of time. Rav Moshe Feinstein, interestingly, has a tshuva, a responsum, in which he says that if somebody swallowed a vitamin or a pill that is meat derivative, that does not require one to wait these 6 hours or whatever amount of time, because that's equivalent to a tavshil, but there's no minhag ever said about a vitamin. It didn't exist, and therefore that would not be included in the stringency. If one merely cooked something that is non-fleishig, something that is pariv, in a meat pot, if I made macaroni, for instance, in a fleishig pot, that does not require one to wait 6 hours. We would not put cheese on that macaroni, at least according to Ashkenazic practice. This is what's called a nosin tam or nosin tam. We wouldn't eat it with dairy, but it is not strong enough to make one considered fleishig. What is the halacha if somebody cut an onion with a fleishig knife? Must he wait 6 hours? Here, some poskim say an interesting distinction. That is, if one ate meat and now wants to eat a sharp food cut with a dairy knife, he must wait. Once one is fleishig, he must wait the full amount of time before eating a sharp food cut with a dairy knife. But some say the opposite is not true. If one cut an onion with a meat knife, that is not strong enough to make one fleishig. In other words, it takes more to become fleishig, but once one is fleishig, the full halacha is in effect, even so far as not eating a sharp food cut with a dairy knife. Some make such a distinction. Okay, are there any people who are excluded from this halacha of waiting 6 hours or whatever amount of time one has the custom to wait? So as I said before, according to Ashkenazic practice, since this is only a stringency, a custom to be machmir, but perhaps not the kur halacha, therefore, if a person is ill, if an ill person just had had some chicken soup, and now a little while later, let's say an hour later, feels that some milk products, some warm milk or something like that would make them feel better, even if they're not very ill, a little bit ill, once they've waited an hour, that suffices. Since it's only a stringency in a case of illness, even mild illness, we need not be stringent. The same is true with regard to children. The post can say under the age of 3, we need not wait. Of course, if the mouth is dirty, if it has meat products on it, you would not want to give milk. The mouth should be clean, but they need not wait. Above the age of 3, some posts can say they should already be encouraged to wait some time, like an hour. I saw in the name of Yaakov Kamenetsky that said actually below the age of 6, it's a chumri yaseira. It's an excessive stringency. One need not be machmir. But others would say that if the child is amenable from the age of 3, we should try to train them a little bit in this practice. Above 6, they should really at least be waiting an hour, and certainly by the age of 9 and 10, the child should be trained to keep the laws of kashrus fully as the parent would, unless there's an extenuating circumstance, but the child should try to wait the full amount of time as per the parent's minhag. Interesting halakha. What if I'm not sure if it's been a full 6 hours or not yet? I ate meat. I forgot exactly what time we finished. I didn't note the time. And now it's sometime later, and I'm fairly certain that we have waited the full amount of time, but not absolutely sure. It's a suffix. So there are those who are machmer, but some posts can say, since it is a suffix, the rabbanon, it's a doubt about a rabbinic law, which is really a chumrah. Therefore, if it's a reasonable doubt, we can be lenient, and we need not ascertain for sure that if the full time has elapsed. As long as it's a doubt in our mind, one may eat the dairy, and that is the accepted halacha. These are some of the halachas of waiting from meat to dairy. Is there any requirement to wait from dairy to meat? If I've eaten cheese, do I have to wait before eating basar? So, look in the Gemara, it sounds like there's no such halacha. The Gemara says, Rav Chisda, on the same page of the Gemara that I mentioned before, Rav Chisda says, if you ate meat, you are not allowed to eat cheese. But if you ate cheese, you may eat meat. It sounds as if the Gemara is explicitly telling us there is no requirement to wait from dairy to meat. However, there is a quotation of the Maharam Mirutenberg, the great Rabbi Meir of Rutenberg, one of the late Balei HaTosfos, the Rebbe of Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh. He was a great Talmud Chacham, a leader of the generation, who unfortunately, the end of his life was imprisoned by the emperor in Germany. This is in the middle of the 1300s, and actually he refused to be ransomed. The Jewish community wanted to pay for him to be released, but he did not want to encourage future imprisonment of Gedolei Yisrael, therefore he refused, and actually he died in prison. He was great not only in his scholarship, but of course in his tzitzit of the Gedolei Yisrael. So the Maharami Rutenberg, interestingly, is quoted that initially when the notion of waiting after eating dairy before eating meat was presented to him, he said, it sounds like heresy. The Gemara says he need not wait. Why should I be more firm, more strict than the Gemara? If the Gemara says it's permissible, we don't make up our own Torah, our own halacha. He says, however, then something happened where one time he had eaten cheese, and he didn't wait, and he went and he ate meat, and he found some cheese in his teeth. So he thought that maybe the halacha should change. This is a surprising statement. Just because of an incident doesn't mean we should change the halacha. And in fact, some of the poskim, the Marshal, one of the early Achronim, said that the Maharami Rutenberg was only talking about himself because of a personal incident, but he doesn't mean that that should change the halacha. However, others disagree, and they say the Maharami Rutenberg means this as halacha for all of us, that one should wait after dairy as well. And in fact, there is a Zohar, a statement of the Zohar HaKadosh, that says that one should be should not eat meat and dairy in the same time slot. The implication of the Zohar is, regardless of the order, whether it's meat first or dairy first, one should not eat both foods. Now, interestingly, normally in Halakha, when the Kabbalistic literature sounds like it's at odds with an explicit statement of the Gemara, the Halakha is we follow the Gemara. Kabbalah is only the spirit of the Halakha, its underlying themes, but Kabbalah does not necessarily dictate how we live our lives, how we in practice conduct ourselves. That's reserved for the Gemara. So normally when the Kabbalah and the Halakha are at odds, we would follow the Halakha. Why then would we be more machmer than what it says in the Gemara? So if you recall the Gemara that I quoted at the outset, Marukva says, I am like vinegar, the son of wine. Some explain, and the Maharam Rutenberg explained it, what he is telling us is that this is an area of halacha where stringency is appropriate, where you can be more machmer than the din. In other areas, perhaps sometimes not appropriate, but here, this is an area of halacha where my father was better, my father waited an extra amount of time, he was more machmer, more stringent, and that's a better way to conduct ourselves. There is room for chumrah. So here too, if the Gemara says that we need not wait after eating cheese, but there's room for chumrah, and therefore if we receive a cue from the Kabbalistic literature, from the Zohar HaKadosh, that it is appropriate to wait after dairy, so we may do so, and it's not considered heresy, it's not at odds with the Gemara, because the Gemara itself gave us license to be more machmir than the din. The Ramah, taking all this into account, says that the accepted practice, at least for Ashkenazim, I believe Sephardic Jews are not, do not maintain this chumrah, but Ashkenazim generally do what the Ramah says, which is that at least after eating hard cheese, which the Poskim say if cheese is aged 6 months or more, we can assume it's considered hard cheese, so there's a greater concern it'll get caught in the teeth, or its flavor remains in the mouth, as Rashi said with regard to meat. So if it is hard cheese, we should wait the full amount of time. If one waits 6 hours after meat, he should wait 6 hours after hard cheese as well. I called my friend Rabbi David Polsky, who receives calls at the Orthodox Union, the OU Kashrus Department. I called him yesterday to ask what cheeses are out there on the market that are aged. And it turns out that Parmesan cheese, by definition, Parmesan or Romano cheese, has to be aged 6 to 10 months to have that title. So Parmesan cheeses, one should be wary of. Cheddar, most of the cheddar we eat probably is not aged. The less expensive cheddars, the Miller and so on, not aged that long. If you buy a fancy cheddar, some of the more elegant companies, Cabot's and Royal George, the imported cheddars, if they have a strong taste, one should look into whether they may have been aged that long. By the way, in the case of Suffolk, if you're not sure if it was aged 6 months, you also can be lenient, because in the case of doubt, and all these halachas, halachas lenient, but if you can find out for sure, you should do so. So a cheddar that is high quality, a very sharp-tasting cheddar, very likely may well be aged 6 months or more. Swiss cheese usually is not aged for more than 3 months, but some say if it's a very sharp cheese, or if it seems like it has it may have been aged for longer. Again, an inquiry is appropriate, but usually not a problem. Blue cheese is also, some are aged for 3 to 4 months, but some for longer, and it's worth looking into. But most of the cheeses that are commonly eaten, at least in America, are not aged, and we usually wouldn't have the problem. But again, Parmesan probably the most likely to be on the lookout for. Okay, so hard cheeses, Ashkenazi custom generally is to be machmir and wait the full 6 hours or whatever number of hours you usually wait after eating meat. There are some people who are machmir in general, if you're eating any dairy, to wait at least an hour or half an hour. However, the primary halacha is that you need not do so, and if you don't have that custom, you don't have to be machmir as long as the mouth is cleaned, which is accomplished by eating and drinking, or by eating a food that has liquid, like a vegetable, celery, green pepper, something that cleans the mouth with both solid and liquid. And one recites a bracha achrona after the dairy meal before beginning the pleshik meal, that would suffice. And again, the only time we need wait longer than that is if we're eating a hard cheese. These are some of the halachas of waiting from meat to dairy and from dairy to meat. I hope this has been informative. Just to go back to the medrash I started with, the Beit HaLevi, the great Rav Shaver Soloveitchik, the father of Chaim Brisker, in his Sefer Beis Halevi commentary on Chumash Parshas Yisro, explains this esoteric medrash. What does the medrash mean when it says that the Malachim lost their claim to the Torah because they ate meat and dairy at the house of Avram Avinu? The Beis Halevi explains that it is only Klal Yisro who have human weakness. We have the potential to violate the Torah. We're frail, and therefore we have to make safeguards. The Torah says only do not eat meat and dairy that have been cooked together, but we have to make halachas not to eat them even cold, not to eat poultry and milk together, not to put them on the same table, to wait in between.
Immersing utensils has nothing to do with extracting or eliminating non-kosher
relevant to brand new utensils as well that have never been exposed to any food. Tevilas kelim, immersing utensils, is a different process. It happens to be that both of these processes come from the same episode, if you will, in the Torah. In Parshas Matos, after the Jews fought the, what's called the Milchamas Midian, they fought against the Midianite nation, which Moshe Rabbeinu was told that was to be his last military endeavor before he would leave the world. So after doing so, they took various different sorts of materials in the Far Booty and loot, and Eleazar Cohen, the son of Aaron Cohen, addresses the Jewish people, and he tells them, first of all, how they should kosher, how they should make them kosher, and he also says, the question which from which word exactly we derive this halacha, either from Ta'aviru Bamayim, you shall put it in water, or from Ha'aviru Yischata, that it should be put into, so to speak, mikveh water, but whatever it is, in that context, the Jews are told not only to cleanse it of the non-kosher foodstuff, but also to put it in water. So here we have the source for the halacha of Tevilas Kelim, immersing utensils, which basically means that food utensils, utensils used either for eating or for preparing food or for food storage in many cases, that are leaving non-Jewish ownership and entering Jewish ownership for the purposes of food preparation, food consumption, has to be immersed in a mikveh. It's a form of conversion, if you will, and the Rishonim actually compare it to that, the same way a person who is this Geyer who becomes converts to Judaism, that person goes to the mikveh. This is a form of converting the kelim. That is the halacha of Tevilas Kelim. Again, it's nothing to do with being non-kosher. I am not allowed to use the utensil until I do that, until I do this process, but it doesn't affect, it's not like cooking a non-kosher pot, which will make the food non-kosher, it's just that I'm not supposed to do it. But it doesn't really affect the food. There are no particles there or anything that's assumed to be there. Incidentally, if I'm acquiring a utensil that requires koshering and tevila, I have to eliminate non-kosher and immerse it, so you're supposed to do it in that order. First kosher, and then immerse. But in many instances, we're buying brand new utensils, so it has nothing to do, you don't have to do the first process, you have to do the koshering process. Okay, so a number of questions that come up. First of all, acquiring utensils from whom? We'll talk about what materials in a second, but if I acquire from whom, so it has to be from a non-Jew. He can either be the manufacturer, or it can be in his possession. Perhaps it was made by a Jew, but then it came into non-Jewish possession, and now I am buying it, so now I have to do Tevilas Kelim. In fact, the post can talk about when we sell the chametz before Pesach, so many Rabbanim sell the chametz that clings to the, so any bits of chametz that I didn't wash out of my pots, I'm selling those minor particles in addition to everything else that I'm selling. Some even sell, for reasons that are hard to understand, but even sell the microscopic particles that might be in the walls of the pots and pans. But what we don't do is we don't sell the utensil. If I sell my utensils for the guy, then when I buy it back after Pesach, you're going to have a mass exodus. After the holiday of the exodus, you're going to have a mass line at the Kaili mikveh to immerse all the utensils, because then I would have just sold it to him and bought it back, so that we don't do, and it would be transferring ownership. Now, it also is only if I'm buying it for food purposes. If a person is buying utensils to sell them and to store, that person, it's very questionable whether he becomes commanded in the mitzvah of Tevilas Kelim. This has a lot of relevance, especially nowadays where in many communities, not yet in Philadelphia, but it will come after a third kosher restaurant, Balakinwood maybe. In many communities, the stores that sell pots and pans have a keli mikveh. They have built in the store a mikveh where you can immerse kelim, which is very convenient. By the time you get home, you can use it right away. You don't have to make a separate trip. So one of the things the post can point out is, so maybe the store owner wants to show up the company. repetition, not only do I have a mikveh, but everything in the store has been totaled for you. Wonderful. So that there's a little bit of an issue with that. If he immerses it before I've purchased it, he didn't have the mitzvah necessarily, because when he owned it, even if it's a Jewish store owner, when he owned it, it was for the sake of business. For him, the pots and pans were not for food. They were to make money to put food on his table, more indirect, so he might not be chayev in the mitzvah. So therefore, it's important that it's only after I acquire it, the purchaser, the individual who bought that's when it should be told. If he wants to do me a favor, then that's fine. But prior to that, it might not yet be obligated in the mitzvah of tevila, and therefore should not be immersed at that time. Yeah.
What if somebody buys you a gift, and they say, I went and I
totaled
it for you?
Yeah, that's okay, I believe. Because they don't own it for business. They own it as a pot. I believe that, yeah, that's okay. Sometimes you don't know where it was manufactured or who made it. I don't know who owned it. So if there's any doubt, we usually are machmir, we're stringent, and would immerse it. However, articles that come from Eretz Yisrael or come from Israel, one can assume, unless you bought an Arab shuk, but which I don't advise, you can assume, or Moshe writes this in a response, and they are Jewish manufactured and were Jewish owned. Yeah. They owned the companies, or they were just running the machine? Yes, so if they're just working, but it's Jewish owned, then it's considered that's an interesting point. But that's still considered relevant to religious article, the Kiddush Cup and things like that. I've never researched it fully, but a lot of them are coming from Eretz Yisrael, and they can be assumed has been only through Jewish hands. So that would not require tevilah. Okay, let's talk about materials. The psukim in the Torah that tell us of this obligation refer to different types of metal. It says gold, silver, copper. There are six metals listed there. So the Torah obligation, most Rishonim assume that this is a mitzvah from the Torah, not a rabbinic mitzvah, but a Torah mitzvah. The Torah obligation is to immerse metal utensils.
Metal,
that's a question. They're responsive about aluminum. Aluminum, presumably, didn't exist then, so the poskim seem to be of a consensus that it is obligated. In the mitzvah, some say perhaps only as a rabbinic mitzvah.
Including those that you buy in the supermarket, I was told, aluminum.
So we'll get to disposable as a separate question, which I have to come to soon. Disposable brings in a whole new issue. But generally speaking, let's talk about permanent utensils. Yeah. I'll stop for one. The Rabbanon was added glass. We tovel glass, we immerse glass, that's a rabbinic mitzvah, not more. Still significant, but which has ramifications in cases of doubt. We'll see that sometimes there are factors that make the whole obligation due to a circumstance, one or the other, questionable. So if it's only a rabbinic mitzvah, we are quicker to be lenient than if it is a Torah mitzvah. So it's really metal and glass. Again, this should not be confused with koshering utensils. Which utensils can be koshered, can be put into a vat of boiling hot water to extract the non-kosher absorptions, it doesn't follow the same rules as which utensils should be immersed when purchased from a non-Jew. Those are two different concepts. Wood, for instance, can be koshered. It's not that common, but if you use wood, a wood keli, a wood utensil, for hot food and it became non-kosher, you can kosher it through boiling water, assuming it's smooth. But wood certainly does not have to be immersed in a mikveh. If you buy a wood utensil, that would be an example of something that does not have to be immersed. Plastic, there are some poskim who are stringent, but the vast majority, and this is pretty much accepted as halacha, is that we do not immerse plastic. Even though the reason for glass why did the rabbis extend the halacha to glass is because glass is in some ways similar to metal, and that you can remake it, you can melt it and remake it into something which plastic would be similar in that vein, but the post can nevertheless distinguish and say plastic is further removed, it's not the same as metal or even glass, and therefore plastic is not obligated. China is a big question. China itself does not need to be immersed. Cheres, earthenware, is certainly one of the materials that does not need it. However, some poskim hold that china should be immersed if it is glazed. Most china has a viscous glaze. It's covered with a thin coating of glass. So the early poskim talk about that if something that doesn't require immersion is coated with glass, it should be immersed. However, there's a debate among contemporary poskim whether they were talking about a good, hefty coating, like a real thick glass coating, not this very, very thin coating that we have on our china today. So therefore, if Moshe Feinstein held that china, that our china today does not have to be oval, I believe Rav Kamenetsky held that way also, so that in the sefer today, but many people do. I personally do immerse china. There are different practices on this question. In any questionable case, we don't say a bracha. We'll talk about the bracha later, but that's the general rule in all of halacha. In any case where you're not absolutely sure it's a mitzvah, so I'm not allowed to say a bracha unless I'm sure it's warranted, so I'm not going to say a bracha when immersing china or any of the questionable cases that we'll mention. You don't make a bracha when you're doing something that you're not sure is really mandatory. You have utensils that are made of different parts. It's plastic on the outside and glass on the inside and so on. Usually, in many of those cases, it's going to require immersion without a bracha. Especially if the part that touches the food is of the material that would be obligated in immersion, so it will require to be able to pass without a bracha, but you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. If the material is very incidental and it really is not an integral part of the utensil, then it wouldn't be so. But if the material that is obligated, metal or glass, makes up a significant part of it, usually that utensil will require tefillah, will require immersion. Okay? Let's talk about types of kelim, types of utensils. As I said in the beginning, it's utensils that are used for food, food preparation, food service, but the halacha does say that a utensil that does not complete the process, that after it's been used, the food is not edible. So a kneading bowl, if it's used only for kneading, or something like that, where you can't eat the product the way it emerges from this utensil, we immerse it out of bracha. That you serve with, forks and knives you eat with, that certainly requires a bracha. Something that prepares the food fully to an edible state requires a bracha when immersed, but something that is used in the food preparation process but doesn't bring it to a state of being ready to serve usually does not require a bracha. But Moshe Feinstein has a very interesting tshuva. He holds that a toaster does not require tevila. We'll talk about electric items in a minute. Anyway, but he holds for a different reason. He says, what does a toaster do? The bread was fine without it. What's your problem? What do you need to toast it for? He says, that's not, didn't really do anything. He says, some people like their bread a little dry, a little browner. He holds that that's not a real process. Many other posts can hold, some posts can hold that you would immerse it with a bracha. So it's questionable. But I just mentioned that because it illustrates the point that the utensil doesn't really fulfill an important process in the food preparation. It reduces the level of its obligation. A nutcracker, not to play. A nutcracker is an interesting question. Rav Moshe Feinstein says to immerse it without a bracha, meaning it's questionable. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says that if it cracks the kind of nuts that you would put out on the table with their shells, which very often is the case. You put out a tray of nuts or something. So then that's considered food. Right? and you put out an orange. So an orange has peel. A nut has a shell, but that's part of the food. You present it that way. You wouldn't put out a chicken with the feathers on. But you would put out nuts in their shell, so that's, it's already considered food. So it's not actually edible, but it's something that is, let's say, servable. So therefore, he says, the nutcracker touches what's considered a servable food, and therefore, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach holds that you would do it with a bracha. I think most people would immerse it out of bracha, but that's a little bit of a discussion in the halacha. Okay, now, a very interesting question is utensils that are sold with food in them. Some of you may have been to a supermarket. There are things that are sold in glass jars and metal tins, metal cans. I've heard about this. I've never seen it myself, but supposedly there are such items in the world. So the next time I buy a can of vegetables, I should go home, open it up, dump out the string beans, run over to the mixer, stick the can in the mixer, run home and put the string beans back and close the lid, right? That would be quite very difficult. So what's the halacha when it comes in? It's a metal utensil. It stores food. Why not? So the halacha is as follows. There are different shitas. Everyone agrees, my impression, that you don't have to do that. What the logic is, it might be that nobody means to acquire something, which is thereby going to make it impossible. If I'm acquiring this can, then the can necessitates me to not have the can, to take the food out, which is like an impossible situation. Somebody means to take possession of it. Or I'm buying the beans or whatever's inside of it, not the can. This is one argument, one svara that's put forth. Moshe Feinstein has a fascinating understanding of the whole issue. He says that when you buy something which is made for its contents, when you buy a can's product, the can is not significant. The can is what we call a tassel. It is secondary to the food. The manufacturer really made food, but you can't sell food loose. You have to sell it in some kind of utensil, some kind of container. So the container is secondary to the food. What he really manufactured is food. If I then decide to use it afterward, I had a can of coffee grinds and I emptied it out afterward and used it for to store other food. So what he sold me, let's say, was a disposable, was a non-keli. It's not a real utensil. It has no presence. It has no individual significance. It doesn't have significance in its own right. I then turned around and said, no, I want to use it for something long-term. So who made the utensil? I did. The Goy manufacturer, the non-Jew, manufactured a disposable item, or an item that is secondary to its contents, and therefore has no significance in its own right. I then turned around and turned it into something to be used long-term, so it's a Jewish-manufactured item. I didn't make it physically, but I made it through designation. I designated it to be used long-term, and therefore he says, this is the story that he puts forth, why one would not have to immerse such a utensil. He writes in that response to him, he writes that he remembers in Russia that they did not immerse these utensils when they would reuse them afterward. So he says that's the minhag. Some would distinguish between if it's metal versus glass. Some would only rely on this if it's something that's only high of midah rabbanon, it's a rabbinic obligation. But many poskim so that we can rely on this entirely, and therefore, if I take a glass jar that was produced with food in it, and then I use it for something else, it was only secondary to the food when it was produced, and therefore it's like I'm making it and it does not require tzivah. There are those who are more stringent. There are some, many poskim that Yisrael held, that you're allowed to use it the first time around without immersing it. You can eat the gefilte fish from the jar, but then when you're finished, don't refill it with something else unless it's terrible. Yes.
Somebody told me that if you use a jar of cream and back into the jar, you can't
eat that. That would assume this more stringent opinion. There are people who hold that way. Many poskim are not nachna like that. I think even among those who are stringent, I saw some say, but if you're just putting it back, that doesn't count. If you use up all the chayin and then you use it to store something else, yeah, that, I think even the machmir, even those who are stringent, some say that they wouldn't, even at least would not go that far. But many poskim are entirely make it and hold that if I choose to reuse it, it's like I made it and it doesn't require tevila at all. Similar, but not exactly the same, disposable utensils, so you mentioned aluminum pans. So we tovel, we immerse aluminum, so what if the utensil is disposable? So if it's only going to be used one time, it's very clear that that's not called a keli, and that's not called a real utensil. That's called disposable utensil. It doesn't have the same halachic status. What the question comes up is if a person reuses it. So some people, some poskim, are machmir and say that if you can use it more than once, that then it requires tevila. However, there are many who say, and many people rely on this, that it doesn't matter if you happen to choose to use it more than once. It is inherently a disposable item, and it's not durable. It won't last long term, and therefore its status is disposable, whether you throw it out right away or a little bit later, so there is what to rely on to use it more than once. By the way, two points that should be made. First of all, if you don't put the food directly on the utensil, it doesn't need tevila. So people who coat the utensil with something else, it wouldn't require immersion anyway. And the second point I'd like to make, a very common misconception, and it seems to be very, very widespread, there's a myth that you're allowed to use it once without immersion. You get one freebie. I think someone just a couple weeks ago called me up, a person is pretty knowledgeable on halacha, but said, is it true that I can use it once without immersion? There is no such thing. I think where that misconception comes from is this ruling that some have with regard to disposable items. A disposable item that many poskim say is used only once, you don't have to immerse. Some say if you're going to use it more than once, so then you should do tevila, you should do immersion. But that is not an across-the-boards rule. That doesn't mean that if I buy forks and knives and I didn't get a chance to take them to the mikveh, that then I can use it one time as a freebie. There's no such halacha. So I think it's a misconception that comes from the question of disposable utensils. Okay, the rules of chasitza. Chasitza means when there's something on the utensil, when it is immersed. The rules of chasitza are really the same for a utensil as for a person. The Gemara says that if a person immerses and there's something covering the majority of his body, that he normally would not want that on him, that min ha-Torah, at a Torah level, that's invalid. The Rabbanan, rabbinic law, extended that to even something covering a small area of the body. It's called a miut umachbid. It's something that's covering only the smallest portion of the body, perhaps, but it's something that a person would not leave there. Those are the rules when it comes to emergency. The same is true with utensils. At least, the halacha is that if there's something on the utensil, dirt, sticker,
sticker residue.
Yeah, by the way, a sticker that's considered a mark of distinction that people leave on to show, I have fancy stuff, and people leave it on, is not considered problematic. Something that's meant to stay there. I haven't seen too much of that. Usually the sticker can take off. So it's a good idea before taking the utensils to the mixer to check them first. Because sometimes you get there and then discover that they have stickers and you end up spending hours and hours trying to take the stickers off. I remember I once had a question that somebody had. There had been some kind of a label that was like rubber cemented on or something, and they couldn't get this glue, this cement off of the utensil, so they asked me what to do. So I spoke to a Rav who I was learning from, a Hasidic Rav, Rebbe, should I tell him the following? There's a suggestion mentioned in the Shulchan in a case where a utensil is so heavy that you can't bring it to the mikveh. Always 300 pounds. What am I supposed to do? It's not a common scenario, but it's too heavy, or for some reason you can't immerse the utensil. So there's a little bit of a trick, which is questionable, but in the case of pressing need, the post can allow it. So what I do is I give it to my non-Jewish neighbor, and I borrow it back. That's it. I'm just borrowing it. I'm not supposed to do that. You can do it. Okay. All my utensils, everything, I just give it away and borrow it back, and then it's a little bit of what we call a harama. It's a trick, and we're not supposed to rely on it, l'chachila, and feel circumstances. I'm not supposed to do that, but in the case where there's no other way to do it, the Shulchan Aruch, the post can talk about this possibility. So I asked this Hasidic Rav, I said, he's got a problem. He can't get this sticky stuff off the utensil. Should I have him do that? He says to me, Gugon. I thought this was a Yiddish word that I didn't know. What do you mean, Gugon? I'm trying to gang it. What's name to you? I don't know what's Gugon. And I only discovered that Gugon is a citrus-based cleanser, which is very, very good. It really gets anything off. You put a little bit of this cleanser and let it sit for a few seconds, and it'll take anything off. I always say in halacha, a good suggestion is better than a sock. It's a good way to avoid the problem. That's better than figuring out the halacha solution. So you should try before getting to make it, just check that the utensils don't have things that are stuck to them. You have already told that you discover afterward that something is there, unless you're right there in the mix, to take it off and put it in again. But if it's going to be a bother, you can ask a shiloh. Sometimes if it's very insignificant, if it's something that a person really wouldn't mind if it stayed on there forever, then often it'll be okay. But if it's something that a person, if you had noticed it, you really would have cleaned it off. You wouldn't sit with that in your dishes or something like that. Then it's going to be more questionable. It's questionable. What's called makted in halacha is very, very.
I'm having to remove
them by night. Yeah. It depends on the case. You have to judge it. You're right. Sometimes, who cares? The stick on the bottom of the mixing bowl. I thought I don't serve with it. I don't know. That depends on the case. So, chachila, I should try to take it off. If you didn't, then you have to. Let me ask a shayla. Okay. By the way, another thing to do if it's something you can't immerse, this is not always a viable suggestion, but if you break the utensil in such a way that it's no longer functional, don't try this with fancy china, but if you break it, or you disassemble it to the degree that it's non-functional, it's considered broken, and you reassemble it, now it's considered Jewish manufacture. And that does not mean a utensil which is normally done in oven, like these, you bake these pies or cakes where you take off the shell after you bake it. That's not called broken. That's the way it's supposed to be. I'm talking about when you take something that's supposed to remain intact and you break it, which again, for many things, is not practical. If you break it, you might as well buy another one. And it's the same problem. But if it's something that can be disassembled and reassembled, which sometimes is possible, that's another way to circumvent the problem of the halacha. Now, electric appliances. Very interesting question. There are some poskim who hold. Now, obviously, the practical issue is that people don't want to put the George Foreman griller into the mixer water. I'll tell you that I have done it. I've immersed all kinds of electric appliances, let them dry out a little bit, and I've never had a problem. But there are a number of opinions here. Some posts can hold that any utensil that is used plugged in, as electric appliances are, is not called a keli. It's not called a utensil. A utensil means not connected to real estate, not connected to the ground. This vessel, this utensil, is always used connected to the wall. So it's in halacha, something that's connected to the wall, it's called mechubo akarka. It's in the ground, and therefore it's not called a movable object. It's not susceptible to wall timber, perhaps, and it's therefore considered above the rules of tevilas kelim. So person will hold this way.
Give it time. There will be. If they don't have it yet.
Yeah, by the way, that's a good point. An oven that, if you have a rack that you don't put food on, that doesn't require to be a lot. You put the food down on the wood, and then if it's removable, you put that. You sort of don't have to, you don't take the microwave oven and throw it into the.
The oven rack you would use.
If you put things on.
Only if you put food in
the oven. Right, if you put food directly on them, which most people probably don't. Often in toaster ovens, the little tray people do put things on, but in an oven usually not. By the way, the type of mikveh to be used for tevilas kalim has to be a real full-fledged mikveh. There are many communities, very large Jewish communities, where they have, this is just a clarification that's important to be made because people do make mistakes with it. In communities where they have what's called a men's mikveh, particularly in Hasidic communities where men go to the mikveh every morning, that mikveh is not built to the specifications that would be valid for immersing utensils. A mikveh for immersing utensils has to be a mikveh that meets all the requirements actually that a woman could use. It's a full-fledged mikveh. There are many more halachos for a full-fledged mikveh. You said it. A man's mikveh really could be drawn water. The water can't be flowing when it's being used, but there are many leniencies that exist. Therefore, if you're ever in a big community, when I was in yeshiva, we had a little rotation to pump the water out of a mikveh. There was a mikveh in town, they needed guys who were around the middle of the day. So once every few weeks, I had to go and pump out the water, and then the cleaning service came in. They wanted to have it done under hashgacha, that people, you know, ways you can make it invalid. So one time when I pumped out the water, the bottom, I soaked a couple of knives. So that's not a good sign. First of all, most mikvahs have a sign that any place where people immerse, they don't want kalim to be immersed because if it drops a glass and it hits the floor, there's nowhere to see it, and it's dangerous. But aside from that, if it's a men's mikveh, should not be used for immersing utensils because it doesn't meet the specifications. In most places, you have a separate kalim mikveh, and that's the safest thing. It has a net, so in case you drop something. A friend of mine once went to a mikveh in Muncie, and he saw a guy that we knew with his legs sticking out of the mikveh. He dropped something, he was fishing down. So better off using the right types of mikveh for the right purposes, but that's an important clarification. By the way, a river would be kosher. A lake is more questionable. Many lakes are man-made. Therefore, the water is really drawn. If the water was brought there through utensils, directly that has what's called a base cable, a receptacle, been through a pump or anything else, then that water, if that's the way the body of water was created, even if the rainwater was added to it, that's not going to be kosher. Many lakes are man-made, but rivers would be kosher. For tevilas kalim. Well, it should have 40 sa'a. 40 sa'a is the amount of water needed in the mikveh, which is approximately 200 gallons. So a little stream generally would be problematic. Some might hold it for glass. It's okay. But usually we're better off with a full-fledged river. Questionable. But maybe for glass is because it's durable. If it comes up, you know, in places where there aren't mikvahs, there are a lot more questions that come up. By the way, in places in the world where it doesn't rain, there's a question about using snow to make even a real mikvah, because when water is not in its liquid state, there's a big discussion in the Mishnayos and in the later Poskim, it might be if it's transferred in that state, it's not like it was actually lifted. It's as if it didn't exist. So in places where there's no rainfall, they get a refrigerated truck, they pile it up with snow, they bring the snow to the mikveh. There's a way that they have it enter the mikveh. There's a lot involved there, and it's somewhat suboptimal, but with no other option than that, Jewish people living, snow can be useful. But if it comes up, one should ask a shayla. It's not so simple to use snow. Yeah. Nowadays, what So Megish will be rebuilt, men will have the same chiyuv in the Torah for tumah and tahara for eating sacrificial meat that will require real tahara. Men going to the mikveh today is mostly a chumrah, just like before davening. It's a nice thing. It doesn't have the same severity. It's a takanas Ezra, an institution of Ezra HaSofer. It's a little bit less of a, it's not a real chiyuv, according to this majority of poskim. It's just for tahara yisera, for everything.
To say a bracha. The same way if I eat food.
I have a spiritual pleasure, so to speak, opportunity to do a mitzvah. I'm supposed to say a bracha on the mitzvah. So it's a difficult situation. I don't want to say a bracha if it's not warranted, but I don't want to not say a bracha if it is. So the best way to do it is if I have something else that requires a bracha. I mean, this is true in all areas of halacha. I'm putting up a mezuzah on a doorway, and I'm not sure if it requires a bracha or not. So put up a mezuzah on the other doorway that you know it does, and say the bracha there, and then go put up the second one. So the same thing over here. You'd say the bracha on the utensil that clearly requires the bracha, and then you'll immerse the other one afterwards. So if it needed a bracha, the bracha was referring to both. And if it didn't, so my bracha was on the first utensil. But you should do it first, so the bracha is immediate to the one that necessarily requires it. Yeah, we do say a bracha on glass, but I think since metal is in HaTorah, according to most, and glass only midrabbanan, that's the same on the metal. But we do say a bracha on glass, even though it's only a rabbinic mitzvah, we would say a bracha.
Do you have crystal glass?
Yeah, but we say, yeah, and if you do relax, you know, all the forms of, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, Chris, I've never heard of anything, you had a question, maybe there's something, I'm not familiar exactly with the professional, Chris, so maybe there's something different,
I don't know why, but it's not a little different, but I think for sure, maybe it was
Okay, I'm not sure, I don't know, if we are immersing a lot of utensils, so I make a book at the beginning. A couple of years ago, there was a couple that got married, relative of mine, and they called from the Katan Sheva Brachas activity. You got all these gifts, so you go to the mikvah. That's the big joyous honeymoon, is going and immersing all these utensils. So they called from the mikvah. When they say the bracha, they have to be quiet the whole rest of the time. So, in fact, it seems from the poskim that Luchat Chila really yes, that we should be making a bracha, and it's referring to all of the whole ongoing mitzvah, all of these items that I'm immersing. So really, preferably, they can talk afterward. Not enough time to talk. But really, we should try not to interrupt, at least with extraneous conversation. If you're talking about something relevant to the mitzvah, that's not a problem. You know, hand me the plate, hand me the fork, whatever it is. Yes, dear. That seems to be the halacha, the Shulchan Aruch, back in the beginning of your day, in the laws of Shechita, it talks about there's a bracha that was said on slaughter. So the person makes the bracha and is going to shecht the number of animals, so the same thing seems to hold true. There's a little bit of a discussion there. The same is true. The halacha talks about a person is putting on a number of pairs of tzitzis, he makes a bracha in the beginning, and he does all. He could really stop. See, the two arguments are on the one hand, the bracha should be referring to all of those mitzvahs. On the other hand, he doesn't have to do this. He's not in the middle of a mitzvah. Once you did one utensil, you've done the mitzvah. But lechila, preferably, lechila seems to be that one should not interrupt. Okay.
If you do get interrupted by circumstances beyond your control, then should you make the bracha again?
I don't believe so. No. I don't think you have to. If it's a long... Yeah, and if it's a prolonged, you end up being called out and you have to run, you know, if it's a prolonged interruption, then yeah, but if it's short, I don't believe you'd make an embracha. Okay? Any other questions? Okay, just to wrap it up with a machshava, with a sort of a thought, it's interesting, the two schools of thought in the world of Musar, the yeshivas, had two different approaches to perfecting, to working on character perfection. One which is known as Slavata, spoke about godless ha'adam, how great a person is. You're much greater than you think. We can all be bigger than we are. We have so much potential. We have to capitalize on it. That is the basic idea of the Slavata school of Musar. And then the Navardak school of Musar, which is a lot less popular today, was the opposite. I'm nothing, you're nothing, you think you're something, you're nothing, we're all nothing. Vardak is alleged, or the legend is that they would go and do things that were deliberately embarrassing just to build character. Go into a post office and ask if they sell potatoes just to feel mortified. It was part of the approach of Vardak. I don't think it doesn't work too well today. We need a little more positive in any event, these are two schools of thought. It's interesting, within the halachas of tevilas kelim, at a sort of a conceptual level, I think you really see both, so to speak. On the one hand, it's very interesting. We know that food is very important in Judaism, in the Torah. You are what you eat. We have the rules of kashrus, of keeping kosher. What's very interesting about tevilas kelim is it takes it a step further. Not only is the food that gives me energy has to be of a certain nature, has to be kosher, but the utensils that prepare that food go through a, so to speak, a purification process, a tefillah. They have to be converted to the task. So even a step further, this is a comparable, parallel to what we have in Halacha. A tashmish de kedusha means something that serves the holy. The Torah is holy. The jacket, the mantle on the Torah is a tashmish de kedusha. It serves the holy. The Torah is holy. The tablecloth on which the Torah rests is a tashmish de kedusha. The table underneath the tablecloth is called a tashmish de tashmish de kedusha. It serves that which serves the holy. So I think the fact that we have a mitzvah tevilas kelim, a notion that not only the food we eat has to have a certain status, but even those things which serve the food we eat, the chicken before the egg, has to be go through this tahara process. Should, on the one hand, be very elevating to man. It's not only the food, it's even the food's food. Once had the vegetarian at our table, and the other guy was kibitzing him. He said, "We eat food. He eats what food eats." Anyway, in any event, that the fact that it goes a step further teaches us, I think, the greatness of man. It's not only my food, but my food's food that should make us realize the greatness of man. On the other hand, I mentioned the story of Moshe Feinstein, the logic that Moshe uses. He says when you have a keli, a utensil, that a container that holds food, so it's secondary to the food. The container, it's as if it doesn't exist. The food exists. The container is only secondary. It's like a shell. It's like a husk. But something that's significant is the food. There's a Gemara in Masechet Shabbos that says that a person carries on Shabbos, but there's no Erev. He carries food. He has to carry a certain measure of food in order to have violated Shabbos, at least at a Torah level. If he's carrying less than that, he hasn't violated Shabbos. If a person carries a utensil, no matter how small it is, if it's a usable utensil, he has violated Shabbos. But if I carry a utensil that's holding a small amount of food, I haven't violated Shabbos, at least at the Torah level, because the utensil is secondary to the food that it's holding. And Rabbi Yitzchak Hutner, the late Rosh Yeshiva, the Yeshiva of Ben Chaim Berlin, has a beautiful essay in his Sefer Pachad Yitzchak. He says this is the whole theme of Shabbos, to teach us that the keli, the utensil, is secondary to what it holds. We're supposed to look at the 6 days of creation and recognize the world is secondary to the ruchnias, to the holiness, the spirituality which it holds. And a person is like that also. Our capabilities, our prowess, our achievements are really only secondary. It's as if it doesn't exist if what's at the core is not significant. If you only have a tiny bit of food, so don't care that you have a nice big can. If there's only a little bit of food in it, nobody's interested in the can. So from the Nevadic approach to Musa, which is also reflected in the Halachos of Tevilas Kelim, we are what we eat, and we eat is what we are what we eat, or whatever I said before, but on the other hand, we are what we produce. We are what we live in Ruchnis and spirituality. So you see both of these themes with the Halachos of Tevilas Kelim. I think it's a good machshavah for us to think of it in the spirit of the Musa of both Slobodka and Nevadic. Okay, next week I hope we will talk about Mukta toys. Same bad time.